part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
My name is Christian Horn. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. I have on the line with me a very special guest, a guest who has been on the podcast twice before, I'm proud to say. Thank you for coming back. We have writer, comic creator, Jeremy Whitley on the line. Welcome, Jeremy. Thank you for joining
us. Hey, how's it going? Oh, my pleasure.
I'm excited to have you on again because you've got lots of projects starting up. But for most listeners and for me, you are more popularly known as the creator of Princeless through Action Lab. You've also written The Unstoppable Wasp for Marvel, and you've done other books for Marvel, correct?
Yeah, I've done a lot of, one-offs and short stories and things like that. Unstoppable Wasp has been, I think that's my biggest thing I've done so far. I did that, and then earlier this year I did a Thor versus Hulk miniseries.
Nice.
Which is a lot of fun.
That's great.
Yeah, and a couple of issues of Avengers, a few things here and there.
That's cool. But you had a big announcement at San Diego Comic-Con, correct? I mean, we ran into each other there. I was there for a day, and I actually got to meet you in person. So that was nice.
Yeah.
It was very nice to meet face-to-face. And you had all your Princeless swag and books out at the Action Lab table. And my daughter actually bought a book of Princeless with her own money. So that should tell everyone how good it is, because it is an excellent book. But what was the big announcement at San Diego that you had that's coming up?
Oh, we had a couple of them about the same time. Volume 7 of Princeless is coming out, but also Unstoppable Wasp is coming back.
Oh, I was not aware of that one. Oh, really? That's great.
Yep.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's... I'm going to have a very busy October, because Unstoppable Wasp is coming back in October. Princeless Volume 7 is launching in October. I'm also doing a Rainbow Bright comic at Dynamite starting in October.
Yeah, that's what I thought the big announcement was, but I was not informed. I did not do my homework.
Well, they did that... week before a Comic-Con announcement thing. They've been sort of slowly leading up to it. I also have a new My Little Pony miniseries launching in October, so it's going to be a very hectic month there.
That's great. That's great. That's amazing. I mean, so you've got, like, what is that, 4 books running? Are they running, like, Wasp is ongoing, Princeless is still ongoing, correct?
We sort of take breaks, but we do, a book each time we have stuff coming out. So actually we have Volume 7 done. That's going to be what starts up in October. And then Volume 8 is already ready to go behind that. So it'll be just like an ongoing series for a while here.
Well,
and then, Wasp is ongoing, and Rainbow Bright, so long as it does well, once it actually starts coming out, is going to be ongoing.
Yeah, well, let's talk about Rainbow Bright, because, I mean, quite honestly, like, that is a property I have not... I mean, I'm a child of the 80s. I grew up around, when all that stuff, Strawberry Shortcake, Rainbow Bright, the original My Little Ponies, all that stuff was coming out. I was not interested in that stuff, but obviously it had its audience, because it sounds like there is a market for Rainbow Bright comics.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of people that really enjoyed the original Rainbow Bright series. I was one of them. I had Rainbow Bright bed sheets.
Did you really?
Yep. My grandmother was sure that my mom shouldn't buy them for me. here I am, 30-some-odd years later, writing a Rainbow Bright comic. So I guess it all worked out in the end.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. How did it come about that, first of all, I mean, it seems like it's a property that's sort of been like languishing sort of like in obscurity for a long time. It's something that hasn't really made a comeback in the past couple of years, like say like something like, you know, My Little Pony.
Yeah, I think it's interesting in that there was, you know, that sort of 80s cartoon boom, and in the fallout of that, a lot of those properties got bought up by, you know, places like Hasbro that you know, own My Little Pony and Transformers and G.I. Joe and any number of other things. And I think Rainbow Bright is pretty distinct in that it is a creation of the Hallmark Greeting Card Company. And so, like, you know, they don't really have a... They haven't had a presence in comics, a licensor, or anything they've worked with. And this is sort of their first foray into that with Dynamite, who's working with me on the Rainbow Bright comic. And yeah, Hallmark has been super excited and super fun to work with. They're open to a lot of suggestions and doing some interesting things with the book, because I wanted to keep a lot of that sort of fun and sense of wonder that goes along with the character in the franchise, but add a little more sort of a sense of an ongoing story to it, because I think the original, like so many sort of 80s cartoons, was aimed at selling a series of toys. So, you know, it's like, what's the thing that happens this week? Oh, well, this is the new toy. So here's, you know, where this character shows up, and then they'll sort of disappear again in a couple of episodes.
Sure.
And, you know, since we don't have a particular toy line to promote or an animated series to keep up with, the cool thing is, you know, we're sort of the mothership as far as Rainbow Bright stuff is concerned right now, and we get to do our own continuity and tell the kind of story we want to tell.
That's pretty cool. I mean, so can you tell me and any listeners that don't know anything about Rainbow Bright? Because, I mean, I remember the show, I remember the designs, I remember the character, I remember it was it was around a lot. I would see the commercials a lot. It was very much a part of like the 80s. But if for somebody like me who doesn't know anything about Rainbow Bright, what is sort of like the background, the basis of that character and her universe?
So the interesting thing when you try to actually go back and watch the cartoons and research sort of the lore of Rainbow Bright is she sort of just pops up fully formed and overpowered in the first episode of it, you know, to sort of save the day. She's, you know, bringing sort of light and color to worlds that are in shadow. She's, you know, come to this rainbow land that's been overtaken by this... you know, this evil shadow king, and she's come in to sort of help take it back and free these, they call them the color kids that, you know, represent each color. And, you know, this is the world that provides color to the rest of the universe. So, you know, she's sort of come in to save the day and rescue all of the color. And I think part of what I like about Rainbow Bright is it is, especially as we're doing it, it is an adventure story. It is a you know, story that has magic and, you know, characters come, you know, the King of Shadows. But specifically, she's a lot like, to me, characters like Wonder Woman, who are heroes, but are defined by qualities that are not always what you see in, like, a comic book hero. They're, you know, defined by things like compassion and friendship and kindness, which, you know, I think is certainly a sort of superhero that we could use more of today.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, the way that you're sort of describing it to me, it reminds me a lot of another property at the time, which was sort of like Care Bears, where like each bear was kind of like a different color. Is there sort of a similarity? I remember that all sort of being you know, Care Bears, Rainbow Bright, My Little Pony, all sort of being part of the same 80s like wallpaper that like decorated mm-hmm. the back of like, you know, our brains when we were growing up. I mean, or a little bit like what Green Lantern has started doing, where the big joke is like, you know, the Green Lanterns are almost like the Care Bears. Is it sort of like that kind of thing where, you know, it's a sort of league of children that all have powers and they correlate to their colors?
To some extent. I mean, that's certainly, I think that's a little more in the way we're directing it. I think it's a little less clear in the original show, like what exactly these kids do and what their function is other than to represent these particular colors. They're not exactly like Care Bears in that they're not tied to a particular emotion. Or you know, the Lantern Corps, for that matter, are tied to a particular value. But yeah, they each you know, represent a color, and Rainbow Bright is sort of the I guess, you know, the person who embodies all of these and can use them all together to sort of you know, save the world.
Sure, sure. So for something like Rainbow Bright, I mean, we met in person and we've, you know, chatted obviously on a couple of podcasts and stuff. And obviously I know your work and stuff, but how does, I mean, a writer, I mean, we know the background of your work, like Princeless, Unstoppable Wasp, and even on Twitter, you're very outspoken sort of towards like female issues and that sort of thing. But, and you told me a little bit about how it went down at San Diego, but how does somebody approach you to say, like, do the Rainbow Bright comic? Have they just heard of you, heard of your work? Or like, do you have like an agent that seeks stuff out for you? How does it work that you become tied in with Hallmark and Dynamite to sort of write a Rainbow Bright comic? Because no offense to you, but looking at you in person, I would think, you know, I'm like, this is not the person we want to write Rainbow Bright, if you know what I mean. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think, you know, it's sort of a series of coincidences and stuff as far as I go. Like a while back, I was, you know, reaching out to Dynamite about possibly doing some work over there and wanted to, you know, do some of their stuff. And I ended up writing a 5-issue arc for Vampirella.
Oh, that's right.
And yeah, I ended up working with Kevin Kettner, who's a great editor over there, who I really enjoyed working with. And, you know, despite having some hurdles to get over on that book, we really enjoyed working together. And I'd been sort of putting a bug in his ear to, you know, if there's anything else coming up that he was looking for somebody on, I was interested in doing more stuff with him. And he came to me with this idea of doing a Rainbow Bright comic. You know, they had just signed on with Hallmark to work on putting something together here. And I wasn't sure early on sort of what it was I had to offer Rainbow Bright. But I think it was, I sat down and did my research and watched some episodes and went through all the articles and stuff I could find about, you know, Rainbow Bright. And I sort of started to get this idea of, you know, I liked what she stood for, but there's a very little like world building and definition in a lot of what they do in the show. Because I think the original series is for all of its like mark it made on the culture, it's like 13 episodes and a movie.
Uh-huh.
Is all the original Rainbow Bright was. And there's I kind of made reference to, there's a lot of stuff that just happens and like it's not really explained what anybody's deal is, and there's not a ton of world building in there. And you know, I saw a real opportunity to sort of build on that part of the story and, you know, still be able to keep something that I felt like was true to the characters and that, you know, fans of the original would enjoy. And so, you know, the more I sort of started thinking about this, the more I got into the idea of writing it. And by the time I had pitched it, you know, Kevin loved what I pitched. And then, as it turned out, Hallmark really loved what I pitched as well. And, you know, of a bunch of different pitches that they had fielded, they liked mine the best. And we sort of went out from there.
Oh, that's great. And how does it work, like, working with Hallmark? Like, is Hallmark saying, like, you, what sort of guidelines are you held to, like, within the character? Because you're saying that there's not, there wasn't a whole lot of world building in their original sort of content. Were you given a bit of, like, free rein to be like, hey, this is the name of the, I mean, I never watched the cartoons, you know, it just wasn't what I was into when I was younger or anything like that. I've never caught up with them. I mean, it just wasn't, I don't know. I was a struggling young teenage boy, you know, and I wasn't, I didn't see Rainbow Bright as the thing that I was going to gravitate towards. But how, if there's not a whole lot of world building or a basis for character or that sort of thing, how much free reign do you have? Like what can you create within that world? And is just the sky the limit for you? Do they have like a Bible and stuff like that, that they handed off to you or something like that?
They had some sort of guidelines of what they were looking for. They were, there's a lot more of like what they didn't want than what they, did want. You know, they were specific about the fact they were not looking to do a, you know, an overly serious, gritty reboot of Rainbow Bright,
sure.
or something like that. You know, they sort of took what Rainbow Bright was about seriously, and they didn't think it was a joke. And, you know, that was sort of where they wanted to approach it from. Other than that, they've been pretty open to suggestion. You know, I think they want to make sure that they serve the fans that exist out there, Rainbow Bright, but they also recognize that there are, you know, a few generations that haven't had a regular Rainbow Bright thing, that are not aware of Rainbow Bright, and they want to, you know, sort of capture those imaginations as well. So they've been really open to trying new stuff, and doing some different things. I think, you know, as compared to, say, I've worked on My Little Pony quite a bit over at IDW, with Hasbro, you know, having a animated series and there being lots of comic books at this point and several like prose novels for children and things like that. There's a lot of continuity that you have to sort of fit stories into. It's sort of nice in this respect, not to need to worry about all of that, but to sort of consider everything that had come before as like a suggestion of things we might work with and might do.
Sure. Was there any sort of like the visual look of the book? Was there any major sort of like redesigns that went into the character? Like, does she have like a brand new look? I don't know that I've even seen any real like solid promotional like visual materials for the series.
Yeah, we've put out covers, but that's all that's come out at this point. Interiors are still a secret as to this point. I think, you know, she definitely looks a bit different than what she did in the cartoon, and also because I think we're taking the time to, you know, sort of let her develop and go from being sort of a regular girl to being Rainbow Bright. You know, she's by necessity looking a bit different. And we're throwing in some new characters, doing things a little bit differently. But also there are, you know, elements of the original that we want to make sure to keep. And that, you know, we want to make sure that this Rainbow Bright continues to look like, you know, at least to some extent, the sort of realistic looking young girl that, you know, is the original, rather than, say, you know, having her look like a Bratz doll who's, you know, tall and skinny and, you know, dresses like an adult woman. Yeah.
And anatomically incorrect in every way.
Yeah. Really, really weird monster children. That's not even taking into account the actual dolls that are weird monster children.
Yeah, that's true. So have you gotten any sense of that this is the beginnings of like sort of a major push to get Rainbow Bright like back into the marketplace, like the beginnings of like the ground floor of like, hey, next we're moving into animation. Hey, we are going to come out with toys. And, you know, if you do good work, like it may be based off of the stuff that you do, like that sort of thing.
I mean, I think that's certainly the hope. You know, I think there's definitely a desire on Hallmark's part for Rainbow Bright to be sort of back in the public eye and to do more stuff with her. I think comics, to some extent, are a nice proving ground, and that, you know, they can invest a relatively small amount of resources into it and see what sort of legs it seems to have, you know, rather than creating a giant movie or animated series or something like that. So I'm, you know, I'm hoping if it does well, if it continues to have the level of interest that, you know, it seems to have with these early announcements, that, you know, there's more to be done there, because I know they would certainly love to do it.
Oh, that's cool. That's awesome. Well, it's great that you're sort of like on the springboard, you know, getting it off the launching pad for them. That sounds like it's a really great opportunity for you.
Yeah, it's really exciting. I like, you know, being the person that gets to lay a lot of that foundation, because I think that's some of my favorite part of writing is building the world and, you know, getting to define all the cool stuff that other people might get to play with later.
Sure, sure. Let me ask you about, because you mentioned it earlier, about Vampirella, because you reminded me that you were working on that book. And this is like the sort of complete flip side of Rainbow Bright, but it's funny to me because I remember seeing the news, I think on Facebook, because you tweet and then your tweets go to your Facebook page, and you'll like sometimes announce stuff on, you know, social media, which is what people are supposed to be doing. And you announce like, I'm going to be doing Vampirella. And I remember being like, what? Like, wait a minute. That doesn't seem like something that Jeremy would be working on, mostly because, you know, in the past couple of interviews and the books that you've worked on, I would say that you very much embrace, for sort of lack of a better term, like progressive, like female values. You're very much into female empowerment with the characters that you write. And Vampirella, whether fairly or not, you know, I don't know if it's, I mean, I think it is kind of fair to say that has been sort of seen as a bit of a, for lack of a better term, TNA character. So how did you sort of become involved with Vampirella and get into that? Is that a character that you had been interested in working on, or did they approach you with it? Or like, how does that work? Because in my brain, it's like Princeless, Unstoppable Wasp, Vampirella, you know? So I'm just wondering, like, how did that procedure work itself out?
Yeah, honestly, surprisingly similar to what happened with Rainbow Bright, in that, you know, I was sort of talking to them about working on something, and you know, Paul Cornell is working on this story on Vampirella right now, and he's leaving after this issue. It's probably going to end, you know, X number of issues later. Would you be interested in sort of picking up this story and doing, you know, those last 4 or 5 issues? And I was like, well, I don't really know what I'd have to say about Vampirella. So, you know, let me do some research. Let me read up on what Paul has been doing, and see if I feel like, you know, there's
like
a story I can tell there.
Like Vampirella, like in your head when they offered it to you, you were like, out of all the things, Vampirella, or was it something you were generally interested in? Because maybe I have a very limited understanding of the character. I probably haven't read enough of it, but again, it does seem something that was basically made to titillate the male, you know, imagination, for lack of a better phrase. I keep saying lack of a better, but
she's got a really, she had a really interesting history, and she started out with, you know, a sort of pulpy magazines as sort of a almost like a horror host for the magazines, and that, you know, she ended up then having sort of horror stories of her own. And then you know, there's a whole period a while back where, like, Kurt Busiek did a run with her, and then, like, Grant Morrison and Mark Millar did some stories, and there's a whole, like, run of, like, really interesting creators doing really interesting things. And the interesting, really interesting thing is they're all different. There's a lot of very different types of stories that the different people have told with her. And, you know, that was part of what interested me, is that there's this sort of large and varied mythology around the character, that, you know, you can sort of jump in and mold her to different types of stories. And, you know, Paul had sort of left his story at this point where is in this, you know, far future wasteland. And I really liked the idea of doing a sort of a Mad Max-y type of, you know, wasteland adventure story with her, where, you know, she gets to be that sort of hero for a few issues. And, you know, we can, I leaned, I think, quite a bit more than usual into sort of the ultra violence side of things, because I think that was a fun chance to flex some muscles that I hadn't gotten to otherwise. So I think I leaned away from the stuff that I was less comfortable with, and more into the stuff that I had never had a chance to do, that I thought would be fun to play with. So I think those issues are pretty pulpy and pretty very bloody.
Yeah, it also looks like you very much like redesigned the character as well physically. Was that something that had been done before you started the book, or was that done when you came on?
So at the beginning of Paul's run, they had done a redesign of her with, you know, with the dress and tights. And I think, you know, myself and Andy, my artist on that, made the decision that, like, we didn't want to go back to the old Vampirella costume, but we also didn't love that one.
Sure.
And we wanted to, since we were going to have her sort of off in the wasteland anyway, you know, so the first thing we do in the story is sort of blow her up. So we sort of blew up the costume at the same time. So, you know, it goes from being a dress to being sort of a ragged, you know, dress over leather pants and, you know, a leather jacket. You know, so she goes more into sort of a biker Vampirella kind of mode.
Sure.
So we took the redesign and sort of ran with it and sort of redesigned the redesign to some extent, you know, for the story we wanted to tell. Because, yeah, I don't think either of us are big fans of just, I don't think the monokini that she normally wears would have made any sense in the story we were telling.
Yeah. Well, it's that outfit that makes it hard to take her kind of seriously, particularly in the modern world. I mean, you know, I am guilty, and maybe I'm being closed-minded or something, but I'm definitely guilty of sort of like seeing, like, A, I'm astounded that they're still making comics with her in them and that there's a large fan base for her. I mean, I guess I shouldn't be, you know, but then there's the part of like that original outfit where there's, you know, it's kind of like eye roll and I'm like, really, really? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that honestly, that is something that, you know, when I was coming on the book, we talked about, myself and the editors, about like, that's that it's, no, I think, well known that that's sort of the perception of her, and, you know, to some extent Dynamite hasn't done much to play that off, because they, you know, they promote a lot of you know, they do a lot of covers for every issue, and a lot of them are aimed very specifically to, you know, be aesthetically pleasing, to be something that somebody sees in the back of a catalog and goes, well, I have to buy that.
Sure, and that is part of the appeal of her of that character. I mean, let's admit it, right?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
and I think it was part of our mission, we talked about this early on, that it is possible to have a character who is sexy and sexual without sexualizing them. And sure. I think that was, you know, part of our aims. There's a lot of stuff in that volume. There's definitely a sex scene in that story. And you know, we wanted to do that without like spilling over into, you know, it being too much for the story we were telling. So I think, I think we did a decent job of keeping it within the lines, but I would, because it was my story. So.
Well, let me ask you about Princeless, because I know that one of the things that you had been seeing on social media for a little while, a little while back, was that Princeless was having trouble with sales, or that people should be buying Princeless as much as possible, and that the book might be in danger of sort of like cancellation or disappearing. Can you speak to that at all? Because I mean, from what I understand, you know, I did go to an Action Lab panel while I was at San Diego, because I have a book that I, you know, helped co-create, and that is at Action Lab Danger Zone. But a lot of what the people said on that panel, my book is called Baby Badass, but what a lot of people said on that panel was that Princeless was very much the book that sort of helped prop that company up, you know, got people taking Action Lab seriously, or was a book that was selling really well. So can you speak a little bit to what you were talking about a little while ago, and is Princeless still okay, or is it still in danger of sort of disappearing? Or,
well, there's you need to make some distinction in that there are two sort of Princeless series that are ongoing.
Yeah.
You know, there's the main series, which is, you know, comes out in volumes. And that series has continued to do just fine. You know, we haven't had single issues come out in a while, but that's because we were behind, not because it was any danger. On the other hand, we also have the Raven the Pirate Princess series, which is ongoing in sort of single issues and has been for a while. You know, and that had some serious issues with sales dipping for a while, because it's a book that was really well supported. There was a lot of nice, you know, word of mouth behind it, but it just didn't put up the numbers that, you know, would actually back up that word of mouth. You know, it was something that we, you know, that I sort of came out and wanted to make a point of saying to people who, you know, were supporting the book, was that you know, it didn't have the sales it needed to keep coming out on a regular basis, and we were going to have to look into other ways of doing it if we didn't find a way to make it work better. And I think we've sort of hit a happy medium in that our sales did go up quite a bit. We did sell quite a few more copies. We sold out Amazon a few times after I put up that post, because there was a lot of support, a lot of people promoting the book and going out and buying, you know, volumes of the book that they had thought about buying but had sort of, you know, left in their cart or whatever. So, you know, it did jump up. On the other hand, the big jumps we've had in sales have been on the side of digital and trade paperbacks. So that's a book that we've recently sort of made the decision to go just with digital single issues and physical trades, because I just don't think the single issues have been sort of healthy for the book in print. You know, we lose money there when we make money on the collections. So it made much more sense for us, I think, to, you know, keep that book healthy by doing single issues in the digital, and then you know, having everything come out together in collections, because that's how our audience prefers to buy it anyway. So doesn't make sense, I think, for us to keep fighting that, you know, people telling us how they want the book.
Sure. I mean, So let me ask you this. Why Raven is sort of the spinoff of Princeless, but that was a book that you, was it that you just had sort of like a passion for the story and you wanted to keep that going on an ongoing, like single issue basis, like continually going, and Princeless would sort of be the thing that would come out in chunks? Am I understanding that correctly? Or, I mean, what was it about Raven that you felt you could support it, you know, as an ongoing, whereas Princeless wasn't? Is that question fair or does that make sense?
Oh, no, absolutely. I think the difference there is more about ownership than anything, and that Emily, my artist on Princeless, and I co-created that book, and that continues to be something that I write and she draws. And with Raven, we have, you know, a couple, we can manage to have a couple different art teams now and, you know, bring people in to do sort of one arc at a time. So it's a little easier for us to stay on a regular schedule with that as compared to, you know, Emily's not, Emily has been doing, you know, pencils and inks for everything there, as well as, you know, teaching art and everything like that. So she hasn't been able to sort of keep up with a monthly schedule on that.
Gotcha.
We wanted to make sure those books are, you know, the books that Emily and I as co-creators want to put out. And yeah, I think we've had a sort of an end point in, you know, what we're doing together on that, that we want to make sure that she and I are the ones doing that stuff. We've had some guest artists here and there, but mostly, you know, her and I want to keep doing that together. And then, you know, Raven is nice because it's a big sort of soap opera-y story, you know, where different sorts of stories can be told in that cast, and we can have a couple different artists doing different types of things at the same time. So I can have, you know, one artist working on one arc while another artist is prepping the next arc. We can keep that going like a, you know, like a regular comic book.
Gotcha. And so has there been any word, I think you might have mentioned last time, as far as like people wanting to option Princeless for like an animated show or a TV show or a movie or stuff like that? Did I hear that correctly? Or was that a bit of news that snuck out at some point?
Yeah, actually, it would have been announced a little bit more than a year ago, because it would have been at the last San Diego Comic-Con.
Gotcha.
That they are doing, we are working with Sony Pictures to make what will be a live-action film.
Oh, cool.
Over there. Yeah, I mean, we're super excited about, they're super excited about. I just got the first draft of the script from them, so they're working on putting together some stuff for, you know, looking for some directors and things to work on that. But yeah, that is, it's in the works.
That's fantastic, man.
Thank you.
That's really great. I mean, Princeless is definitely a thing that my daughter and I have both loved, and obviously she thinks it's fantastic because, again, I will say to anybody out there, my own daughter plunked down her own money at San Diego to buy the book. It's funny because we have one of the review PDFs from early on, and she still wanted to buy the paper book. And I was like, okay, like, you don't want to buy any of the later volumes? And she was like, no, I want this one. And I'm like, okay, she loves to reread stuff. So you're doing something right for sure with Princeless.
Yeah, great. It's a book that, I mean, it's been with me as long as my oldest daughter at this point. I've been working on that book for 7 years, and it is like a child to me now. So yeah, it's always great when like new stuff comes out and we get to share it, because it just keeps, it keeps being a thing, and I love to hear that people are still discovering it and still enjoying, you know, the older volumes as well as the new stuff as we put it out. It's awesome.
So let's talk about The Unstoppable Wasp, which was another series that my daughter and I both loved. I just said it's a series that we both love, but we were also like really sad when it ended. I may not have clued into, you know, enough stories as to why it was ending, but can you talk a little bit about that? Like, why was The Unstoppable, was it canceled? Was it just put on a hiatus? I mean, I know it's coming back, but when they told you that it was ending, I'm assuming they told you, got word that like, hey, Jeremy, this is ending. Were you surprised by it? Or did they say like, we're ending it now, but we're going to bring it back and we're going to bring it back with you? How did that whole sort of thing play out for you?
We found out, with plenty of time. Basically, I was well ahead on writing the book as it was, and I think it was about the time that issue 4 was coming out that they said, look, where the numbers aren't there to support continuing to put this book out at this point. We're going to go ahead and end it. Initially, they had said it's 6 between myself and my editors. We managed to sort of talk them up to 8 because we thought that was a much better endpoint for the story with, you know, what I had set out at that point. Because at that point I had already written through 7 and I was working on putting together 8. I was like, no, please don't stop at 6. Because that would be a terrible place to end the story. We ended up going to 8, and I got to, you know, finish the story where I wanted to, which was really nice. It's something they don't have to do, but they did. They had said at the time, like, we don't know how this is going to do. You know, we do want to do more stuff with the character. She's going to be around in other books. She was in Avengers, and she's in Champions now. But we'll see if it does anything in trades, and if it does, you know, maybe at some point there's sort of an outside chance we might get to bring it back. And then it sold like gangbusters in trades.
Oh, that's great.
It did much better in trade sales than it ever did in single issues, partially for, you know, reasons that I had emphasized to them at the time, and that, you know, it's a book that's very popular with librarians and schools. It has a younger audience that might not necessarily be the, you know, comic book store audience.
Yeah.
That turned out to be true, and they came through. A lot of, you know, librarians and educators supported it, and I think a lot of people discovered it, you know, after it had already ended. And there's a lot of, you know, I got tweets on a regular basis for a while. It was like, oh, I can't believe that this book ended. I never read it when it was coming out. And I was like, yeah, that's the problem. That's why it's ended. Because, you know, people weren't reading it when it was coming out. But, you know, to Marvel's credit, they contacted my editor and said, this is doing really well in trade. We'd like to do more. We'd like to give it a second chance. And, you know, they said specifically they wanted to bring back, you know, that book that we were writing. They didn't want a different, team. They didn't want a different angle on it. They wanted to, you know, tell that same kind of story. So they asked me if I'd come back to it. And I was thrilled to, because I loved writing that book. I love Nadia as a character. And, I love all the characters that we created in that first volume who get to keep, you know, living on in this volume. Elsa, who was the artist on the first volume, wasn't able to jump back on because she's got 800 other projects right now. But we got Guru Hiru on art, who had just wrapped up doing Gwenpool at that point. So it was sort of a nice bit of providence that they were free, because I think it really keeps the light and airy tone of the story. And it looks and feels like a lot of fun, which was one of my favorite things about, you know, the book the first time around, is that it's a comic book that you can pick up and it looks like fun.
Yeah. It's interesting. The preview art that I've seen for the new series is just gorgeous looking. And did you say it's like an art team? Is it one person or several?
It's Guri Hiru are a They're a pair of women in Japan who, they did all the art on Gwynpool when that was coming out. And then, you know, they did, if you've read any of the Avatar The Last Airbender comics, they did a whole bunch of those. And also, they happened to have done the first Marvel Comics project I ever did with me, which was they did the story in Secret Love that I wrote with Misty Knight and Danny Rand.
Oh, that's cool. So they're based in Japan?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's amazing. That's great. So you've mentioned to me that, like, Raven was having some problems with, like, single issues, and then the Unstoppable. First of all, like, the Unstoppable Wasp, to me, it seems like you would need maybe, I mean, the numbers couldn't have been that low, right? To just want to cancel it after 8 issues. I mean, how many issues were in the trade that came out? Was it all 8?
The first trade was 4, and then the second trade was 4. I think by the time the first trade came out, the book had already been announced as canceled, unfortunately.
Yeah. I guess what I'm wondering is, like, it seems to me like, is it setting up the Wasp to fail again to do it as single issues? You know what I'm saying? Like, would it work better to do, like, trade-sized editions of your story and have them come out like that, since that's when it came out as a success? And then I guess sort of my other question to you is, like, what kind of lessons are you learning about single-issue comics through these, like, two sort of experiences? Because to me, it seems a little obvious, but maybe, you know, I'm not looking at the minutia of the situation. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the economics of producing single issues are a little bit different for a company like Marvel than they are for, you know, somebody the size of Action Lab. And Marvel has, you know, for the most part, made a commitment to, all of their stuff coming out in single issues and going through comic shops. You know, they have some books that are digital first, but those are pretty rare and pretty specific, mm-hmm. you know, and are generally outside of continuity. I think just the way they've done business for 75 years at this point is to do single issues on most everything. And they've tried graphic novels here and there, but to, I think, sort of limited success. I think partially because everything that Marvel puts out is in continuity. So, you know, you've got stuff happening at the same time as other things, and having everything come out monthly, I think, just makes more sense to them, at least. They can, you know, the numbers that get a book canceled at Marvel are numbers that we would just absolutely love to have for something like Raven.
Sure.
That just having the Marvel name on something, you know, guarantees a certain number of sales, regardless. I think for them it just makes more sense to do it that way. And at the very least, I think their single issues sort of advertise the eventual, trade sales. That's still a fairly new marketplace for, you know, companies like Marvel and DC, who have been, you know, in the business of doing, you know, 32-page comics for 75 years.
Yeah. But are you given any sort of, like, for the new Wasp series, are you given any sort of, like they're like, Jeremy, come back. We want you back. Come back. And are you like, well, you have to promise me that you're not going to cancel it after 8 issues? Like, do you get any sort of guarantee? Do they wait for the trade before they say they're going to cancel? Because it seems like, let's just say, like, Image Comics, right? Like, mm-hmm. Image Comics, when, at least from what I've noticed, like, when they get ready, like, when it's time, when they get enough issues to release a first trade, they release the first trade. You know what I'm saying? They don't wait, like, a long period of time. You know what I mean? And it seems like DC, Marvel, they wait. And I don't know necessarily what they're waiting for. They wait like several months or something like that. And it just seems to me like, you know, there might be a different way. I guess what I'm concerned with, as far as like the new Unstoppable Wasp series is concerned, like that you come back and there's great work made and done again, and everyone looks and goes, well, these single issues aren't selling. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there's always some danger of that. And that is, you know, something I've said on social media. It's, you know, make sure if this is something you want to keep happening, you need to support it. And just supporting doesn't necessarily mean just tweeting about it, but, you know, getting out there and buying and pre-ordering books, so that, you know, Marvel knows that this is a book that people want. You know, that said, I hope in the case of Unstoppable Wasp, both that it's sort of generated more of a fan base in its, you know, time of being available in trade and people discovering it. But beyond that, you know, Marvel can see sort of how that book was successful in the long run, and we'll hopefully keep that in mind as we go into, you know, this second volume. Because I know, you know, that's something we've talked about is, you know, that it is something that'll be more successful in volumes probably than single issues. But at the same time, you know, Tom Brevoort has told me a few times that, like, you know, there's very few promises when it comes to monthly comics. Sure. You know, you gotta make sure you put your A game out there and tell the story you want to tell, you know, and don't depend on the fact that, you know, you might get to tell it somewhere down the road. Yeah. You know, make sure that every story that comes out is the one you want to be telling.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to me because I just definitely, I mean, we've seen it for years that there's a different dynamic that is going on between single issues and trades and stuff like that. And it's weird. I'm just wondering if we're sort of getting past the point where single issues need to be developed to push, you know, collected or a large size paperback, you know. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, obviously, nobody seems to know the answer to that.
Yeah, I think that's something that Marvel and DC are trying to figure out even now. You know, DC has started doing a lot of that stuff where they're, you know, producing collections of stuff directly to Walmart and, you know, having things that are more, even if they still come out in single issues, that are more self-contained, you know, and that people can pick up otherwise. And, you know, DC is also with their YA lines doing, you know, graphic novels, you know, that are not in continuity. You know, the jury is still out on how that's going to go, because those books haven't come out yet. But,
yeah,
you know, I think there's definitely a library market out there. And, you know, I think it's a pretty open market. I don't think people have figured out, I mean, certainly the big two companies have not figured out exactly how to get to that market yet.
Sure. And as far as the Wasp goes, do you ever get any dictates as far as like the movies are concerned? Because obviously the Wasp in the movies is different than your Wasp. Is there any sort of thing of like, you know, don't use Janet or Hope Van Dyne? I mean, obviously you did in the first, you know, Unstoppable Wasp series, but is there anything that you're supposed to avoid? Because maybe people or allude to or not allude to, because people go see Ant-Man and the Wasp and then they want to pick up your book. Like, do you ever get sort of any guidance from Marvel? Like, can you use this character? Can you please do this? Like that sort of thing? Or are you pretty much just left to your own devices?
I think for the most part, I'm left to my own devices. I think there's some amount of, there's more like, oh, we probably shouldn't do this unless like you should do this. They're pretty open to letting me sort of develop my own stories and just do the things that I want to do, which is nice. But, you know, occasionally there are like questions of, oh, you know, if we create a character like this, or we put a character like this in the story, is that going to confuse people who are coming to this from the movie who sure. might not, you know, for instance, if we were to use like the ghost from the comics, who is a, you know, who is a man and a computer hacker, and that's sort of his deal, as compared to the ghost from the movie, is very different. You know, then there's some worry about, you know, the potential that that could confuse people. They might not understand what's going on with that, or might, you know, pick it up for this character and find that character is not who or what they think it is. So, you know, we try to avoid that kind of stuff. But no, there's very few like dictates on what needs to be in it or what they would like to be in it. So.
Yeah, that's cool. Cool. Yeah. So when do all these books come out again? When is Rainbow? Is it all October?
It is all October.
That's amazing. And the stuff is in previews now.
Yep, it is all in previews. It is all available for pre-order. You know, Rainbow Bright is through Diamond. Obviously, Unstoppable Wasp is with Marvel. Princeless and Raven are both with Action Lab. And then also have the My Little Pony Nightmare Nights miniseries that's starting out that month as well.
Oh, Rainbow Bright is through Dynamite, correct? You said Diamond.
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Oh, sorry,
you can order it in Diamond. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Any upcoming appearances or cons that you're going to that you want to let people know about? Or?
Yeah, I'll be at Dragon Con in Atlanta during the upcoming holiday weekend. So that's right at the end of August, beginning of September.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be an awesome con.
It's a really interesting show. It's pretty wild because they take over basically all of downtown Atlanta, and it's a big 24-hour day party for just about a week.
That's great.
Yeah, it's definitely something everybody should try once. On top of that, I think I'm doing SPX in Bethesda, which will be September 15th and 16th, and then New York Comic Con at the beginning of October. And then I think other than we've got right at the beginning of November, I'll have NC Comic Con here in Durham. But that's the rest of my year.
Nice, man. That's awesome. Well, congratulations on all the work. I'm really happy for you. I'm really happy that Unstoppable Wasp is coming back. I'm glad that you've been reached out to for Rainbow Bright. I'm really glad that Princess and Raven are still alive and functioning as properties. And, you know, and as always, thank you for coming on the podcast, because you've always been a very generous guest. And, you know, I really appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to come on and talk to you about all this fun stuff that I usually have my head down writing. So,
yeah,
so I tell somebody about it.
Well, it was great meeting you in person finally. Someday, hopefully, maybe we'll get to chat longer in person, because it was on the con floor and everyone's got their stuff to sell. So, but you know, thank you for coming on to Part-Time Fanboy, and you know, it was great to sort of connect a visual with the voice that I've heard over the Skype line for the past several years.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Anytime, Jeremy. Well, this has been the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. I have been on the line with Jeremy Whitley, who is the writer of Rainbow Bright, Unstoppable Wasp, Vampirella, past issues of Vampirella, and upcoming series of My Little Pony, and lots of other great stuff. Thank you, Jeremy, for joining us. And thank you out there for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-Time Fanboy doing my thing.
Part-time fanboy.